I want to touch a very complex subject today, very simply, just to say the Rashi Prakav, at least the beginnings of understanding of a complex subject. And it's a little bit different than the style that we've been doing until now. I was nesayer to it because of different experiences, different things that people said to me over the last few weeks. Okay, so we're a few days before Shavuos. We've already benched Chodesh Sivan. We're holding a few days before Shavuos. And we know that in the Seder of the way Klal Yisrael works, there's no such a thing as coincidences. There's no such a thing as that it happens to be the Parshas Bamidbar comes out a few days before Shavuos. It doesn't work that way. Everything that the whole Klal Yisrael does as a whole, every minig, every halacha, every Seder, fits together into one beautiful picture. So, and as far as I can talk about, why is Parshas Bamidbar before Shavuos? Sometimes it's immediately before Shavuos. Sometimes there's another, like this week, there's another Parsha in between. But Parshas Bamidbar is one of the introductions to Shavuos. So we search, and there's many, many things to find. We search in Parshas Bamidbar for things that are going to make us ready for Shavuos. Because that's the idea. Parshas Bamidbar is a hachana to Shavuos. So the first thing in Parshas Bamidbar and Chumash Bamidbar is the counting of Klal Yisrael. So we'd like to discover what the point is of the count. What's the point? What does Hashem want to get out of the count? The census. It's a few times in Chumash we find again and again counting Klal Yisrael, counting Klal Yisrael. Why is that important? Okay, that's the first thing in Parshas Bamidbar. We move on. The second thing in Parshas Bamidbar is the Parsha of Degolim. The Parsha of Degolim is the Parsha of flags, is the way, the setup of the way the Yidden was set up in the Midbar. So you had a Mishkan with the Mizbeach and the Kodesh Kadashim and the Kodesh, and the Levium lived around it. And then you had four, in the four directions, you had four sets of three Shvatim, including Ephraim and Manasseh, that's 12, with the Levium in the middle being the 13th. And they were set up in a certain order, and each one had its degel, had its flag. Also, another whole parasha that each shevet had its flag. It demands some explanation, like what's the point of it, what's the uniqueness of it. But even more so, because we have a tremendous medrash. The medrash says that when Klal Yisrael stood by Har Sinai, and here we find even in medrash, the Matan Torah in Parshas Bamidbar, Klal Yisrael stood by Har Sinai, Chaf Beis Rivavos Malachim came down to Har Sinai. 22 tens of thousands, which is 220,000 malachim came down. Some agoras, it was 220,000 sets of malachim, or groups of malachim. A massive, tremendous amount of malachim came down with the Shechinah on Har Sinai. And Klal Yisrael, when they witnessed the godless of Matan Torah, they also saw these 22,000 malachim, and they saw that the malachim were set up, degolim, degolim. The malachim had flags. And they thought it was so inspiring that they were hisavu l'degolim. They had a taiva, they had a desire for degolim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I promise, HaKadosh Baruch Hu swore that he's going to give them degolim, and that's this week's parsha, Ish al Diglai. Ish al Diglai ba'oisois l'veis avoisam yachanu b'nei Yisrael. Each person by his flag. We have a pasuk in Shir HaShirim that says "V'digloi olai ava," which literally means he showed me, he demonstrated his love for me. But Chazal understand "V'digloi" means and his flag, olai ava, was for me his love for me, because Hashem promised I wanted the flag so badly. Hashem promised it'll give me the flags. "V'digloi olai ava." So what is this? What did they see? What did they want? A beautiful flag. Like, why can't they make themselves a flag? What were they asking for? And finally, before we move on, finally, the lashon of the pasuk seems to be is interesting. Ish al digloi, the golem were for the shvatim. Each shevet had a flag. Each group of three had a flag. I think each shevet also had a flag. Each human being didn't have a flag. Each individual yid belonged to a shevet which had a flag. So it should say shevet al digloi. It should say each shevet should camp with its flag. Why does it say ish al digloi? If it wants to say that a person should live with his shevet, so let it say that. But the point is that each shevet had its flag. Why does it say each man with his flag? Okay, we live in a very, very, very accepting society. A very understanding and accepting society. And more as time goes on, society learns to accept and decides to accept stranger and stranger and stranger things. Plurality, individuality, acceptance, these are big words in America. Allow each person to express their own uniqueness. These are big, very tremendous American concepts. In terms of the klal and in terms of the prat, it's something that we have to deal with. We'll start with the prat. Each person could serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in their own way. So one person could serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu by focusing on davening very much. Another person by focusing on Musar and on Midas. Another person by focusing on Lundas. Another person by focusing on Bikiyas and learning a lot of Gemara. Another person could become a Rav or get involved and enjoy examining Halacha. There's different ways that each person could serve Hashem. Many people have their mitzvah that's special to them. There's unique ways to serve Hashem. Sometimes the person says, the way Hashem wants me to serve Him is not by doing this mitzvah, by doing this thing that's not right, that we consider not right. And that person sometimes demands of us that we also be understanding of his individuality, that he feels his calling and his individuality demands that he do something that's not within the realm of Torah and mitzvahs. Accept me the way, before I go on, this has nothing to do with loving every yid, respecting every yid, being nice to every yid, being kind, caring, davening, giving, connecting with every yid. This has nothing to do with that. This has to do with validating another yid's lifestyle. This has to do with validating another yid's lifestyle, that just like I'm entitled to serve Hashem in my way, you're entitled to serve Hashem in your way, even if you think that Shabbos is a mashal. It doesn't really mean in actuality that you have to keep Shabbos. It's just a mashal. Okay, you could serve Hashem in your way. There's such a trend in America, and I'll explain why soon, why I think, even though in the yeshiva community, you wonder why is it so relevant, I think it does penetrate. Community-wise, it gets much more touchy. It used to be, during the Enlightenment, when Reform and Conservative started to grow and develop, there was tremendous reservations and tremendous tremendous upset in the camp of Orthodox Jewry because there was these other groups that were developing. But there was equal animosity the other way as well at that time. I have here a quote from Rav Hirsch. He describes what used to go on. This is something that doesn't go on today. Describes what used to go on. And so we have lived to see rabbis and boards of trustees armed with government edicts, with the help from the police and with the authority to deprive their fellow Jews of the right to work, who manipulated synagogues, worship, and all the sacred institutions of the Jewish communities. We have lived to see how in the face of this despotism, the time-honored prayers and the ancient hopes expressed in them were silenced, how new liturgies were introduced, synagogues were closed, and Torah scrolls were carried off. We don't have that today. We don't have that hatred of that someone's going to come into a basement and pull out the Sefer Torah. We have lived to see how the Torah true members of the community had to take refuge in cellars, in the woods, and even abroad in order to be able to worship in accordance with Torah law. We have lived to see how in the face of this, it goes on here, but different descriptions, but traditional schools and their time-honored modes of teaching were silenced, how school children were forced to flee to attics and barns with their Torah textbooks, weeping as they watched their Torah teachers being driven out of the city. These are descriptions that we're not familiar with. We have seen how they pursued the Torah into the houses of worship and convinced the police to forbid Jews to gather on the Shabbos for readings from the lessons of the prophets. We have seen how the manipulators of these powers pushed for the repeal of concessions made by the government to help Jewish businessmen observe the Shabbos. We have seen how they hurled the lightning of their tyranny even at the purity of Jewish lineage, enforcing the registration of non-Jews as Jews in the records of the Jewish community. Okay, in Israel, maybe there's a issues with this a little bit, but as a whole, this type of anger, you know, to have a reform movement angry at orthodoxy, pulling the Sifrei Torah out, chasing Rabbanim out of a city, today's day and age, Tavshin Samach Dal, we don't have that. Which is a wonderful thing. But it creates a problem that we have to understand, digest, deal with. What it creates is a feeling in the world, and someone who's been out in the world understands that feeling, that while conservative and reform are very understanding of the right of orthodoxy to exist, orthodoxy is not understanding of the right of reform and conservatism to exist. In other words, our narrow-minded and stubbornness, it becomes an issue when put up against the backdrop of the philosophy and the shittas of this country. It's a problem. I allow you to worship however you want. I don't have a problem with this. It's not like in the days of Rav Hirsch that I had a problem with the way you worship, that you had a problem with the way I worship. No, I'm very tolerant. I appreciate your devotion to Hashem the way you perceive Him. And I would like to worship Hashem the way I perceive Him. These are things that we've heard. I pulled out some old Jewish observers because they many times deal with these types of things. There's a group that there was a group many about 15 years ago that was trying to unite conservative, orthodox, and reform to become a dialogue, to accept each other, to appreciate each other. For example, Pliny, whoever it is, likens the differences between orthodoxy and other groups to the disputes between Hillel and Shammai, about whom the Talmud said both are the words of the living God, and Hasidim and Misnagdim. In line with this approach, whoever it is, calls for an interchange of pulpits between Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform rabbis to clarify ideology and values of their movement to a new constituency. In other words, there's a... And this, I was shocked how much this is still relevant today. This was a few years ago. It's so relevant today. In other words, there's a feeling in the world, and if you go into the world, when people look at the Haredi, at the Frum community, that, what do you mean? For generations there were different ways of serving Hashem. Hillel had one way of serving Hashem. Shammai had a different way of serving Hashem. Hasidim have one way of serving Hashem. Literature have another way of serving Hashem. Sfaradim have a third way. We have a fourth way. Why are you being so hard on us? What's the answer? We have to be able to answer this question. We have to be able to answer this question. To explain, is it a lack of Avas Yisrael? Do we feel under attack? What is the answer to this question? Why is it that while the world seems to have moved towards such acceptance, that Orthodox Jewry still announces and still proudly proclaims that while it respects every single individual, and I can't stress that enough, while it respects every single individual, it cannot give validity, what they call spiritual validity, to certain groups. So again, so you have this on a yachid, on an individual basis, and you have this on a community basis. I think it's an important thing. Let's get back to Har Sinai for a moment. The Luchos were given, Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the Luchos, and it said on the Luchos the words of the Aseres HaDibros. And the Psukim say that when you looked at the Luchos, if you turned them around, you were able to see the letters, they penetrated straight through. It wasn't just engraved like people engrave a stone today. It was straight through the Luchos, straight through the tablet. You were able to see from one end to the next. Mizeh umizeh in Ksuvim. And there was a tremendous miracle. It says in the Gemara on Shabbos that when they read the words of the Luchos, so the words read a certain way. You had a bays shaped the way a bays is shaped, and a gimel, a dalid. Now, ordinarily, if you would turn that around, everything would be facing the wrong direction. Hashem made a tremendous nace that when you turned it around, they were still all facing the right direction. A big nace. However, the Gemara says, however, the facing the right direction did not apply to the whole world. And the Gemara gives an example. The Gemara says the word nevuv, which didn't exist in the Luchas, is a little bit problematic. But the Gemara says the word nevuv, nun beis vav beis, if you turned the Luchas around and you looked at it, you would see all the letters the right way, but it would spell bubon, which is nevuv, backwards. And you have to ask yourself, why couldn't it spell nevuv? Once the Nes is switching all the letters, why couldn't the Nes, would it have been that difficult for Hashem to make a Nes that it would switch the words as well? Let it switch the whole word, that when I switch it around, I could read the Luchas. Isn't the whole point that I should be able to read it both ways? Isn't that the point? I heard an incredible thing about this. The way the Torah was given and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship with Klal Yisrael is not like that of other of Avodah Zarah and other things described in Chumash, that we're completely bottle, we completely disregard ourselves completely in light of our service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's not the way Avodah Hashem works. The way Avodah Hashem works is that each person is given his strengths, individuality, opinions, feelings, approaches, emotions. Each person has his life and the things that shaped him. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants each person, based on his angle, and the generation he lives in, and the country he lives in, and the tkufa, and the type of personality that he has, to serve Hashem with his angle on Yiddishkeit. However, and here's where we start getting to the point. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Luchas on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's end that says Nevuv. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu wouldn't want that it should just say Nevuv on my end. Or else HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have made me a cardboard cutout. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me my personality and my feelings and my emotions and my opinions that I can have a certain chiddush in Torah, a certain angle in Torah, a certain flavor of Torah that's something different. That's this idea of being mechadish divrei Torah, being mechadish mahalchim in Torah, being mechadish ideas in Torah, but with one tanai. It has to be looking at the luchas. If I'm not looking at the luchas, then I'm not saying nevuv or bubon. If I'm looking at the luchas and I'm focusing on the luchas, so then I'm standing over here, my vantage point is this way. You're standing over there, you see it from a different vantage point. And you see it from a third vantage point, and everybody sees it differently, based on who they are, based on the type of personality that they have. Everybody sees it differently. But everyone's looking at the same luchas. Bubon is bai bina. Bina is understanding. And bina, the type of understanding that bina is, Chazal say, the word bon, bina, is like the word ben, a son. Bina, the type of understanding that bina is mevin davar mitoich davar. If you tell me something, so I understand from that a second thing. That's my take on it. Nevuv, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's angle, kaviyachol, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives it in the hands of Chachmei Yisrael to learn Torah our way. We sit in the Beis Medrash, and we use our seichel, and our koichas, and our personality, and our emotions, and the whole totality of our being to come out with bubon, with our bina, our maven davar mitech davar, based on what Hashem gave us, what that means to us, and how that develops, and how it digests inside of us. Okay, that's all in theory. Let me just explain how this comes out in Lamaisa. And this is something I was shocked. I discovered a few weeks ago that even Bacharim in yeshiva sometimes don't understand the truth and the absoluteness of this Yisrael. That's why I think it's important. I'm shocked. I'm shocked that it is, but I think it's important to talk about. There's something called halacha. There's something called hashkafa. Halacha is not a fundamentalist view on Judaism. It's not dependent on my ideas about things. It's not dependent on my emotions. It's not dependent on my attitudes. Halacha is an absolute. What do I mean that it's an absolute? That means we were given a Torah Shebiksav, and with it we were given a Torah Shebaal Peh. We were given 13 ways to darshan the Torah, and based on those 13 ways we have to understand the Torah. And generation after generation, Chachmei Yisrael dedicated the absolute power of their minds and their logic to develop and to understand the what the halacha is. A guy told me a few weeks ago that he thinks that if certain Rabbanim wouldn't be so orthodox, they would come out with different psakim. A regular yeshiva guy told this to me. They wouldn't be so frum, they wouldn't be so yeshivish, let's say, they would come out with different psakim. That's an impossibility. Because psak is an objective science. It needs siyata dishmaya, and it needs kedusha and tahara, that's a different discussion. But when we roll up our sleeves in a base medish and we deal with a sugya, it's without shuckling, and it's without views, and it's without fundamentalism, and it's without orthodox leanings, and without certain types of hashkafa. It's an absolute logical quest for truth. We're looking at the luchas, and we're defining and understanding the luchas. That's what we're doing. It's a quest for truth. And that's it. That's what now, two people, you have a Ktzayis HaChayshin and a Nesivis HaMishpat. The Ktzayis sat down, he learned the Gemara, and he looked at the Luchais, and he heard of it on the Luchais, and he came out with a Ktzayis. The Nesivis went and looked at the same Luchais, and he had his angle on the Luchais. Buban, he had his angle on the Luchais. But they were both using this absolute system of understanding Torah in a logical way, the way we were taught generation after generation from Har Sinai. The Yidden by Har Sinai, their attitude towards Torah was the same as our attitude today. It's an absolute. Every word that Hashem says, we have to do. The way that Hashem said to understand His words, that's what we have to do. When Hashem said, keep Shabbos, it wasn't a mashal. When Hashem said, lay sirtzach, it wasn't an idea. It was literal. It's also tremendous ideas. It was literal. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, listen to the Chachamim said, it was a chiyuv to listen to what Chazal say, which is a chiyuv to obey Divrei Chazal. It's a chiyuv to listen to Torah Shebal Peh. It's as it says in Torah Shebiksav, it says you have to listen to Torah Shebal Peh. It says, Lay Sasar Min Advarim Ashiyar Melech HaYam and Usmail. You have to listen to Torah Shebal Peh. And when the Gemara says to shake a lulav, it's not to remind yourself of something interesting that we could think about in the beginning of, in September. It's an actual chiyuv to take a lulav. And if there's Gedayel that spent hours and hours and hours taking apart a lulav to see if the top is split or not, it's because that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. That's an absolute. And two Gedayelim can have two shitas. Oh, when it says in the Gemara, when it says in the Yom Rulucha, when it says in Torah Shebal Peh, it says it shouldn't have a split top. What does that mean? Does it mean one split, two split, an inch, 2 inches? What does that mean? But that's all angles on looking at the luchas. It's a very, very, very important thing to realize. This is the difference between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, Chassidim and Misnagdim. This person serves Hashem in this way, and this person serves Hashem in that way. All of those people, generations of different types of Avdei Hashem. All the generations of different types of Avdei Hashem. The idea behind the Avodas Hashem was to discern, to pull out, to squeeze out the truth of Ma Hashem Elokecha Dor Hashemim, of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, with the system that was handed down for generations. So if you had to draw the line, this is complex because there's many grays, it's not so easy, it's not always so simple, but if you have to draw the line, what type of group or individual can we say, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves individuality. Why do you think HaKadosh Baruch Hu made so many individuals? And someone who will say, Chas v'shalom, Chadash is Asar Menat Torah, you can't do something different. What's the difference between the two? Why is it that I could sit with a Chassidish Yid and I appreciate his minhagim and he appreciates my minhagim, and I'll sit with somebody else who thinks that Shabbos is an allegory or something as allegorical, and I can't identify with that because he's not looking at the luchas, because he's not using the system. It's not an attitude. It's not an attitude. It's not a fundamentalism. It's not a style. It's not a trend. Someone else told me a few weeks ago that he thinks that orthodoxy goes in trends, generational trends. We don't have trends. We have a system of dedicating ourselves to working out what the truth is in every generation. And that's what keeps us vintage from, absolute, perfectly from the way we were from for thousands of years. I don't know, I cut it out. Someone showed me this whole, everyone's familiar with the tumult about the Sheikh Lach. It was a big tumult about Sheikh Lach. So it was the front page of the New York Times on Friday. So I have the article. There's one line, it's nothing to do with Sheikhs. There's one line that I want to pull out of that article. I have it here. One line, I think it's very interesting. For thousands of Orthodox women, and so on and so forth. Okay, So the women, they cover their hair, and adhering to the code of modesty that prohibits a public display of their hair after marriage, were thrown into turmoil this week by a ruling from a distant authority. You hear the cynicism? You hear it? More than 5,700 miles away in Israel, several rabbis issued a ban, they didn't issue a ban, issued a ban on wigs made in India. You hear it? This is classic New York Times subtle cynicism. The guy writing this was laughing to himself. 5,700 miles away, some rabbi said, India, no good! It's not the way Yiddishkeit works. That's their amaratus. There's a system. It didn't become the style, it wasn't a trend, it's not a fundamentalism, it's not an idea, it's not an attitude, it's not an emotion, it's a system. There's a halacha, there's a mesechta about Avodah Zarah. There are halachas about Avodah Zarah. There's Shulchan Aruch about Avodah Zarah. There's tshuvas about Avodah Zarah. They have to be dealt with and ruled upon logically, carefully, devotedly. And anybody who talks about trends, about views, about feelings, about emotions, is ignorant of a mass amount of Jewish scholarship. You understand, it's not just that it's not true. It's insulting to us. When someone says, if this Rav would be a little bit more understanding, he would be matir this thing. You're turning away from a massive amount of scholarship, of intelligence. Would anybody say about a physicist that came out with a new law of physics, he finally discovered that if he would have been a little bit of a nicer guy, the law would be different? That would be an insult. Physics is a science. The guy could be a horrible person, he could be a nice person, he could be an emotional person, he could be a logical person. Science is a science, and it runs a certain way. And to say that if he would be a nicer guy, the law of physics would be different, is an insult to his intelligence. Frumkeit is not a question of attitudes and trends and emotions. It's an insult to our intelligence. We have a whole shas. We have Rishayim, Achrayim, Tshuvas, geniuses in Psak, geniuses and Masmidim, and people who gave over their lives to grow in massive amounts of scholarship and understanding and thoughtfulness and practical understanding of the world. That's looking at the Luchas, that's Hillel and Shammai. That's Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish. That's the Ksais and the Nesivas. That's the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon. That's Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonis and Ibishitz, perhaps. That's many different places, given many different places, looking at things differently. Because everyone's angle is different, because the luchas look different to everyone, but it's everyone adhering to the luchas. I found an amazing thing in this Jewish Observer. They quote, people might say, like, that maybe the less yeshivish from people don't hold that way. He quotes here. It is well known. I guess I could read it if it's well known. It is well known that right-wing rabbinical leadership has not always been in full agreement with the views of the leading mentor of modern orthodoxy, Rabbi Yosef Daiv Soloveitchik, Rosh HaYeshiva of Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. Yet, there is no disagreement among them in this regard. As Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, this is quoting from Rabbi Soloveitchik, "From the point of view of the Torah, we find the difference between Orthodox and Reform Judaism much greater than that which separated the Prushim from the Tzedukim in the days of the Second Beis Hamikdash." The Tzedukim were Kaifer and Torah Shebal Peh. They said there's no Torah Shebal Peh. And Rabbi Soloveitchik from YU, who's considered the person, the one from all the Gedolim who's maybe more understanding, more broad-minded, he writes that the difference between Orthodox and Reform Judaism is much greater than the difference between the Prushim and the Tzedukim. Has Jewish history ever recorded an instance of a joint community council or a joint rabbinical council which consisted of Karoyim and Torah true Jews? This is Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rav Huttner writes, there was a letter. There's a whole big difficult issue, and it comes up today again and again. And I think it was the 30s or 40s, maybe it was even a little bit later. maybe it was even a little later, about joining the New York Board of Rabbis. It was the 50s, what? The 50s. Joining the New York Board of Rabbis, if from Rabbanim could join the New York Board of Rabbis, which consisted of rabbis from all the different movements. And there was a letter written and signed by every single gadol in America, Rabbi Moshe, Rabbi Yaakov, Rabbi Yaffin, Rabbi Gedalia Shor, Rabbi Putner, basically every single Rosh Hashiva and gadol in America, saying that it's absolutely awesome. Absolutely awesome to join. Sounds so mean. Sounds so mean. But we're saying now, I think it brings a certain appreciation of it. There's a difference between people whose Judaism is governed by trends, by attitudes, by feelings, by the times, and people whose Judaism is governed by pure scholarship and dedication to unchanging. That's the difference. And every single different part of Frumkeit has that same dedication. And then we can appreciate the different parts. Rav Huttner writes, I'm not going to open it now, it's getting late. Rav Huttner writes, he says, the hatzlacha of conservative Jewry is that they're so liberal that they even appreciate orthodoxy. They even accept orthodoxy. That's what he writes. It's a Rav Huttner insight. That's different than the days of Rosh Hashanah Rafael Hirsch. And again, I'm not talking venomously about conservative and reform, especially today. Most reform and conservative, it's just the way they grew up. It's what seemed right. It seems so American. It's not. I'm not coming here with tirades and venom. I'm just coming to explain what seems like a narrow mindedness is really an appreciation for our Yiddishkeit. It's an appreciation for focusing on the Luchas, the Degolim. Klal Yisrael stands by Har Sinai, and they see 22,000 malachim, or groups of malachim, coming down with the Shekhinah, and they have flags. They have Degolim. Why don't they all have one flag? Why do they have different flags? Because they're all different. Because they're not all the same. And each flag represents the strengths that unifies that particular group. But not every group is the same. Everyone's different. But yet they all surround the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. Surrounding HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all the unique variety of Degolim. That's they saw Malachim coming down. Degolim, Degolim. 22,000. I wonder if it's similar to 22 letters of the Aleph Beis, which are all different. All different than each other. Every letter, no two letters are the same. And they never lose their uniqueness. But if they don't join together to form words, sentences, and paragraphs, they're useless to us. 22,000 Malachim, all different. But if they don't join together, they don't rally around the Kisei HaKavod, they don't rally around the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, they're useless. The whole godless of their differences is their unity together with their differences. Focusing on the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, these are the Malachim, this was at the time that Klal Yisrael said, Naseh V'Nishma, just like the Malachim, absolute dedication to whatever Hashem says. And at the same time, I carry my own degel, I'm different. I'm on this side of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, and Kavi Yochel, and they're on that side of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. My angle is this way, their angle is that way. We're not all the same, but our goal is the same. Our focus is the same, and that creates an inherent unity that allows us to appreciate our differences instead of being torn apart by them. Klal Yisrael had a taiva for the Degolim. They also wanted some type of a system to appreciate each one's role, each Shevet's role, their angle, their place in proximity to the Shechina. Levim should be here, and Reuven should be here, and Shimon should be here. They also wanted to be told and taught, what's my uniqueness? What's my role? Where do I stand in relation to the Torah? And they would, and so HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'digle alai ava, out of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's tremendous ava, he revealed to them your direction. If you look in the Kli Yakar and the Sfarim, you'll see they darshan the directions. Why Reuven is shaykh to this direction, and Shimon is shaykh to that direction, and Levi to the closer in, and Gad to be, and Dan to being in the back, and all the Shvatim, why they're shaykh to the different directions. This was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ava to show you that in your unified dedication to an Aron Kodesh that's in the middle, this is your uniqueness and your uniqueness and your uniqueness, and you could all serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in your own way, with your own individuality, with your own kayach, all focusing on that central Aron Kodesh. That's what that was the taiva of the degalim. Counting Klal Yisrael. Counting Klal Yisrael is exactly the same thing. We're used to in a country, you can count, they send around a form, you fill it out, they mail it back, and that's how you count it. Because the counting is to know how much the tzibur is. It's not a care for the yachid. The counting in Klal Yisrael was not that way. The counting in Klal Yisrael was with tremendous sensitivity to the yachid and how he fits into the tzibur. Listen to this incredible Ramban. Very famous Ramban. The oid, he said, Raman says that each individual would walk in front of Moshe and Aaron and say his name. Imagine that. Every single individual, this is being counted. Imagine if they did that here. This is being counted. Every individual went in front of the king and the Kohen Gadol and said his name. Ki habolif nei av hanaviyim. Someone who walked in front of the av hanaviyim, Moshe Rabbeinu. The achiv kedosh Hashem, and his brother, the Holy One of Hashem. V'hu noida aleim, and he makes himself known to them. Vishmai, by his name. Now Moshe Rabbeinu knows me. I introduced myself to him. Yehaloi b'davar hazeh z'chus v'chayim. This will be a big z'chus and it will give him life. V'chein l'kulam z'chus b'mispar. It's a z'chus for each of them to be counted. Sheyimnu l'fnei Moshe v'aren. That they should be counted in front of Moshe v'aren. Ki yosimu aleim einam l'toiva. Moshe Rabbeinu will give his toiv eye and he'll look at them positively. He'll look at them drawing out their individual strengths and appreciating that each individual is chashuv. Isn't this an appreciation of the chashivas of an individual? Yivakshu alayim rachamim. Moshe Rabbeinu will daven for each one. Hashem alekei avoseichem yosef aleichem elef pa'amim v'lo yamit misparchem. Incredible tzura. Rav Hirsch writes a similar thing in when he talks about Parshas Shkalim. As if Rav Hirsch was listening into all this conversation, he writes so to the issue. This common purpose, he's talking about the counting, does by no means diminish the importance of the individual. Rather, because of its diversified demands, the Avodas Hashem requires a variety of resources, and therefore the participation of a wide spectrum of personalities. The counted ones in Israel are counted for the service in the sanctuary as individuals with reference to names, families, and tribal affiliation. When the nation of Israel counted its own, it reckoned them as individual tribes, individual family units, and individual personalities. In this, Klal Yisrael emulated Yaakov, who gave the same bracha to all of them. The Pasuk says he gave them all the same bracha, but he was discerned in each of his sons the dominant qualities that were to characterize also the tribes descending from them. The lion strength in Yehuda, the merchant in Zevulun, the perseverance in Yisachar, military skills in Gad, agricultural expertise in Asher, eloquence in Naphtali, and so on and so forth. By so doing, he imparted to each of his sons and to their tribes after them an equal blessing, which they would be able to realize only if each of them made use of his personal traits and talents. In the same manner to this day, the work for which Hashem appointed his people and to which he summons every member of his people year after year cannot forego the contribution of individuals. Hashem's sanctuary is in need of them all. It counts on soldier and priest, merchant and scholar, farmer, artist, craftsman. It counts on every individual in every walk of life, each with his particular personality molded by his family background, his home and his birth, his natural tendencies and his personal fortunes. This is what we're talking about. Is this an orthodoxy that doesn't allow for individuality? Is this an orthodoxy that doesn't appreciate each person's individuality? Chas v'shalom. We need, that's what he says, we need each person's individuality as long as we're looking at the luchos. And that's the lesson of the counting. We're all counted together, but as individuals. And that's the next parsha, the lesson of the degolim. We all have our own degel, but we rally around the Aron Kodesh. And that's why it says, b'lashon yachid, that's why it says, ish al digloi to be merames, that just like each shevet has its degel, each human being, each individual also has his degel. Ish al digloi. It's true, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is just megala to us, the degel overall of each shevet. But within each shevet, each person has his own degel, his own traits that he has to be proud of, a degel, something that we're proud of, that he could use to grow in Avodas Hashem, to help the community, to shtay, to bond with other people, to be makar of people to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whatever the different kaychas that people have, that's ish al digloi, but around the Aron Kodesh. Just as a footnote, while I was preparing this and I was reviewing in my mind the history, I was looking at Rosh Hashanah Hirsch and reviewing in my mind the history, just for another minute or two. It's important to realize, and there's an interesting letter that I want to read to you. It's important to realize that it's not just that this is the sheet of Frum Yidden, but that this is the reason that we're still here today. This is the reason why Orthodoxy is still here today. The Karoyim are not here, the Prushim are not here. Even the original Enlightenment, the original people, the world, there's nobody, there's no Talmidim of them. It's all developed and changed and grown and corrupted and twisted and so on. The only thing that stayed 100% the way it was back then, no matter what anybody said, no matter how many people predicted otherwise, was Frum Yidden. One of the people, the big predictors about the demise of Frumkeit, was Abraham Geiger. Abraham Geiger was a colleague of Rosh Hashanah Shofar Hirsch when they were young, lived in the same time, and he wrote a line. He was a blunt person who expressed in very, very blunt terms his disrespect and his design for any type of mila he can call barbaric and tarfus he called I don't even remember, very, very, very blunt bizionistic terminology to all the values that we hold dear. So they have here a letter that this is 1986, that Rabbi Avi Shafran is a very good writer, wrote to Abraham Geiger. He wrote him a letter. It's called Abraham Geiger, Are You There? It's a very nice letter. I'm only going to read a little part of it, but I found it very entertaining, so I thought I would share it with you. I'm just going to read a few paragraphs. Abraham Geiger, Are You There? We're well aware that you've been dead 111 years now. A shame, for there can be no doubt that today's world would interest you. After all, as a self-proclaimed visionary, you placed your every hope on your view of the future. You were born, we know, in 1810 and rose in importance to become a leader, if not the leader, of the early reform movement in Germany. Your views were strong and uncompromising. Ironically, you are much more intractable than the primitive observant Jews that you so pitied for their inadaptability to the times. Foremost, you were a crusader for new Jewish order. Life, spirit, scholarship, and research, you wrote. Life, spirit, scholarship, and research, you wrote, have outgrown the confines of the statutes of the Shulchan Aruch. We no longer wish to heed the voice of Moses Isserlish of the Ramah. You were to be well admired for your forthrightness. So many of your colleagues, though in full agreement with you, would often wax diplomatic, pretending not to change but to fulfill the law, and so on and so forth. Not you, Abraham. Abraham Geiger was to the point. No beating around the bush. That was your way. We today admire your honesty. Unfortunately, for your sensibilities, the Mappa is just as accepted by today's observant Jews as it was in your day. The Ramah's voice was somehow not stilled by your declaration. It is still heard constantly in every Beis Medrash and evident in the workings of every observant Jew's homes. And look at these homes, B'li'ai and Hara, the sheer number of them. Surprised? Well, of course. You made it abundantly clear how you felt that the Orthodox Judaism was rapidly fading into oblivion and should indeed be encouraged to do so. As it happens, though, more and more Jews are joining the ranks of the primitives. Balei Tshuva have tellingly attained the status of a movement. And so on. I'm moving now to the end. You had predicted the cessation of interest in Talmudic literature, the cessation of belief in its holiness, its divinity, when we ourselves have finally outgrown the Middle Ages, in quotes. Sir, the yeshivas, the kollelim, do you see them? Gemara and Rishayim lapped up with fervor, intelligence, and dedication. Do you see the scientists, the doctors, the lawyers, and the university scholars adhering to their Daf Yomi schedules so zealously? The shiurim and steady siddurim on campuses in private homes? The strength of the dedication, the sheer volume of the sheer volume of the learning itself astounds, and so on and so forth. What we're most telling, though, of your life and your attitudes were your often expressed emotions for your country, Germany. You had little patience for the nationalistic aspirations of medieval Jewry, the longings of your people for their land. "I love Germany and must remain here," you wrote. "German thought and German scholarship were to you the supreme achievement, expressions of all human intellectual achievement. All your eggs you happily and proudly placed in that venerable basket. Had you only lived 3/4 of a century longer, your country, Germany, did not develop into the ideally fertile soil for Judaism's growth that you had envisioned. Do you recall a sermon you once preached?" And he quotes, "Rejoice, my brethren, for the eyes of the German law watches over you, protects you. You may be at peace, dwelling in security. In the radiance of the royal benevolence, there is life and security, shelter from all danger, and protection from any attack. Indeed." Are you listening still? Just 8 years before you spoke those words, Rav Hirsch penned the following. This is quoting from Rav Hirsch. "All the idealism and hopes brought about by the Age of Enlightenment in this century, to which people have attached their hope for the future, have not even passed the first test. There are no signs that humanity will now be capable of bringing about a new and better order. Abraham Geiger, your beloved Germany has failed you in ways too horrific to recount. The antiquated Talmud, the obsolete Isserlish, survived intact. Allow Jews to survive and flourished along with them afterwards. Behold Abraham Geiger, the world you left but a century ago. Behold the vitality which is the Torah world today, and behold the remnant of your students and your philosophy. You are a Jew. May Hashem spare you pain. It is punishment enough for you to be an eternal example. For you stand as a warning for Jews in all generations, a warning never to forget or abandon the mission of a Jew. A warning never to see our heritage as a burden, but as a gift. A warning never to be fooled into doubting our inherited knowledge of the Torah's divinity. A warning never to put our full trust in the whims of governments at the expense of our trust in our Creator." And according to what we said today, I'm adding to that warning. A warning not to feel, and this is what we're talking about today, not to feel comfortable taking that individuality and those feelings and the appreciation of a country and the appreciation of a world that we live in without that focus on the Lord. "You serve to remind us to remain Jews as Jews always were, as Jews always should be. We really should thank you for what is a precious legacy."